From WXXI News, this is Innovation Friday on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection is being made this hour every day in our community, but with people from around the world who need help. We're talking about medical interpreting, and since the rollout of the Affordable Care Act, medical interpreting is more important than ever. We're going to learn all about it this half hour and take some of your comments and questions as well with some professionals who can help us do that. And I'd like to introduce them first. Let me start by introducing Eric Candle, who is the president of EC Data National Training Institute. He's also the U.S. coordinator of the International Medical Interpreters Association. Eric, how are you?
How are you doing? Thank you for having us here.
Good to have you here. And we also have Ty Smarpat, and Ty is a field outreach interpreter for Oak Orchard Health, which is based in Brockport. Ty, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
All right, before we get into some of the meat of this discussion, I'll let you know the phone numbers. If you have questions about medical interpreting, these kinds of issues, you can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can also join the conversation online, and I want to ask each of our guests to explain a little bit about sort of the broad outline of what you do. So, Eric, give me a sense for what you do with EC Data National Training Institute.
Let me start with the scope of the problems, and then we will see what we do and why we do it. There are 60 million people in the United States that are not in the position to communicate in English. So any services that we provide normally for people within the same language environment, they will not be able to communicate with doctors, legal providers, social services, educational system, and that's why you need professional medical interpreters, professional legal interpreters, professional educational interpreters. Within the International Medical Interpreters Association, our main goal is to advance professional medical interpreters, create standards of practice, code of ethics, provide national certification for medical interpreters. And within our company, National Training Institute, we provide the highest level of training for professional medical legal interpreters.
Okay, and Ty, give us a broad outline of what you're doing.
So for Oak Orchard Health, we offer medical translation for all patients who want to come in, but we also offer services to the actual camps. And we go out to the camps with nurses and providers. And what I usually do is I'm the intermediate between the nurses and providers and the workers. Most of the time, workers don't have access to come into the clinic. So what we're doing is going there, offering immunizations, blood pressure checks, basic medical services at a basic cost like anyone else.
And by the way, Ty, you speak what languages?
English, Spanish, Portuguese, French, and Thai.
And Eric, you speak what languages?
German, Polish, and Russian.
And English marginally well. You left that
yes,
out there.
In some yeah. cases. Yes.
Okay, very good. So you just kind of get a flavor of what we're dealing with. The editor of the Innovation Trail is Matthew Leonard, and I know this is as timely as ever an issue.
Well, Eric and I actually connected. People who were listening to Healthy Friday last week may have heard some of the reporting we did from the 2014 National Refugee Health Conference that was on here in Rochester, which was a really interesting occasion of bringing a whole lot of healthcare providers and refugee community representatives who all work with people, obviously trying to navigate the healthcare system in other than their first language. And Eric bailed me up and made some very interesting points about the role of medical interpreters, and so I'm glad he can join us. Thanks for being with us, Eric. But also in terms of some of the other reporting that we're doing around the rollout of the Affordable Care Act and the some of the uptake of people who, you know, who are now, you know, going to have access to services. So give us a sense of how has things changed really since the Affordable Care Act kicked in, Eric, if you can give us a bit of an
overview. Yes, if we go down to New York State level, out of 60 million people that I mentioned in the United States, 5 million people in New York State are LEPs, limited English proficient, patients, clients, customers. In the greater Rochester area alone, and people don't realize how diverse our community is, it's about 160,000 people that need services of professional interpreters. 50% of them are Spanish speakers, and the rest in 50, 60 different languages. The Affordable Care Act, and it's an important component of professionalization of medical interpreting, the Affordable Care Act has one of the major requirements related to the 30 days readmission rate reduction requirement. out of all the people that are being readmitted within 30 days to our hospitals, 50 to 55% are LEP patients. If we can address the needs, cultural and linguistical needs of LEP population, of LEP patients, we can take care of all the requirements under Affordable Care Act. Here is a direct connection.
So, great. Just so I'm clear about this. So you're saying that the requirement under the Affordable Care Act of around readmission, standards around readmission. So readmission is someone who they're treated, they're given a prescription, they're sent home, the condition may represent, they may forget to take their medication, there may be other factors that lead them to being readmitted. You're making a link to limited English proficiency patients being a large proportion of those people who end up having to go back and be readmitted for the same condition.
It's obviously a very complex issue. You know, there are so many different parameters why you're being readmitted, but now under Affordable Care Act, there are three major conditions, which is pulmonary diseases, and two conditions related to the heart failure, which is a heart failure and a myocardial infarction. If within 30 days you are readmitted after being discharged, you're readmitting within 30 days, it constitutes 30 days readmission.
Right.
So, and as I said, 50 to 55% are LEPs. If we take care of them, we can drastically reduce the cost, because readmission costs in many cases $60,000 to $70,000 a day. By taking care of these needs with LEP population, we drastically reduce the cost.
Right. So in terms of the scale of operation, say that the need for interpreters within the 160,000 people that you identified here in Rochester, how many interpreters are what sort of a workforce of medical interpreters are out there, if you can tell us?
You know, it's very hard to say because there are so many different categories. There are professional interpreters. There are dual role interpreters and might be medical providers, and they work as medical interpreters. There are ad hoc interpreters, unfortunately, people that are not trained, not credentialed, not certified. In many cases, family members, even minors, would provide the services. We know that in the United States today, according to the Labor Department, there are about 45 to 50,000 people that are involved in interpreting.
Right. I was going to ask you about the role of family members and younger children who often have bilingual capability. If they're the next generation, they're often relied on to provide that kind of facility in a family. What kinds of things can go wrong, or why can that present problems if you've got, say, a younger family member interpreting for their uncle or aunt or grandmother, for example?
Not to scare our listeners, but last year in the United States, we lost about 96,000 patients because of miscommunication, because the healthcare communication is extremely complex.
Right.
And even for the person of the same language, it constitutes major issue, because the language of medicine at the level of bachelor's and master's degree and the average level of the appreciation or comprehension of information is the sixth or seventh grade level. So that's why we highly recommend not to use, it's our strong position, not to use family members, not to use minors, for many reasons. Number one, lack of knowledge of medical terminology, lack of knowledge of understanding of confidentiality, accuracy, and completeness, emotional involvement. So sometimes people might be biased because they have their own interests that they will not adequately express when they work with the patient and the provider.
Or there may be cultural factors that come into play about communication, about men and women's health issues as well.
Gender-related, yes. If you speak Spanish, 26 countries in the world speak Spanish. They all have different cultural background. French language, so it could be French from Canada or French from one of the African countries. Drastically different cultures.
Right.
All right, let's grab a phone call here. This is in Farmington. Keith, thanks for calling Innovation Friday. Keith?
Evan, another very good show. A quick comment. On the readmission of people who speak other languages other than English, is it proven cause and effect or more anecdotal? Because I have experience in the healthcare field, and we've had times where we need interpreters, and it's usually a family member, and it's either a family member or a friend. Sometimes it's a grandchild if it's an older person. But the readmissions that we run into are done basically because the insurance company wanted them out, not because they didn't.
All right, so let's start with that question. Eric, can you address He says, do we know that there is a causal link there?
Not necessarily. So what I would address here that any medical facility would have a language access plan. And within the language access plan, they will deal with all the issues of interpreting and translation. So the insurance companies now, by the way, are directly involved in a community effort of addressing the needs of LAP patients because they can drastically reduce the cost of insurance services for the patients.
Keith, follow up there?
Well, I do agree with him about the need for interpreters. Even on law enforcement, occasionally needs interpreters. But the biggest issue is, again, from experience, is the insurance company saying, okay, this is all we're going to pay for. You got to discharge your patient. And then a day later, they're back in the hospital.
Keith, I understand it's slightly different points. So, talking about the practice of admitting with a very specific status, if it's under 72 hours, so the patient is not fully admitted to the hospital, and in this case, you might or might not see this patient as being readmitted, but it's a slightly different issue. We're specifically addressing here the need of professional medical interpreters for LAP patients.
Just, Keith, thanks very much for calling in. Amongst the literature that I came up when I was doing some research for our discussion today, I did find a study from the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at the University of Massachusetts Medical School that found, kind of slightly skewing the same point, but nevertheless, the length of a hospital stay for limited English proficiency patients was significantly larger when professional interpreters were not used at admission or discharge. So, I mean, of course, the literature will go backwards and forwards. Another study that was really interesting is one that was done by the University of California School of Public Health looking at 35 medical malpractice suits where a language barrier was involved, and they found that all but three of those language access to proper language interpretation had been a factor in the malpractice suit. So, you know, perhaps not giving the empirical drill down that our caller wants, but nevertheless, there's definitely some interesting literature out there.
The cost of service is dramatically higher. The issues of patient safety is involved. Liability issues, because general malpractice insurance will not cover issues of patient safety if the services were provided by a non-professional medical interpreter.
Right. And if I can ask, jumping in on Twitter, Pat is asking, and again, we kind of touched on the need for interpreting, what's the best route someone can take to become a medical interpreter? We'll start with Ty.
Yeah, so the route I took was I took several Spanish courses in college, and I made it my focus. And I took that and applied directly to Oak Orchard, and they were in need of interpreters at the time. There's about 10 of us now. And it was as easy as that. I did an interview, and they realized how necessary it was to have interpreters and how much of a need it is at the current time. And so, I mean, that's how it went. It wasn't so rigorous or difficult. I mean, you can go far in linguistics and do anything with it, but medical interpretation is basically just learning the language and just the medical terminology to add on to that.
And forgive me if I missed this earlier, but you said you were learning Spanish in college.
Right.
And then since then you've added a number of languages.
Right.
Right. Is there a baseline number that you need to be able to be proficient in to be a medical interpreter?
No, I mean, our where I work in the rural communities of Brockport in Monroe and Orleans County, it's mostly Hispanics. And in this area in Western New York, it is mostly Hispanic.
Yeah. So you gotta have Spanish.
Right. And there's a few Haitians in the area and a few Brazilians in the area, and I just assisted with that just for that need.
So tell us about what's a typical kind of scenario, you know, when you go out on an outreach clinic, an immunization, or just a health
right.
clinic
so,
for
right.
the people
so,
you're working with?
The schedule for me goes like, we'll find these camps, we call it scouting, we find these camps, and you know, these people live out in the middle of nowhere most of the time. It might be a house that looks empty, but there could be 20 guys living in there in like meat conditions. So we go out there, we register them, make sure that everyone's in check, you know, there are familiar faces because we go every year. And then once they're registered, we take a nurse and a provider out to where they are and offer basic services to what they need, immunizations. And
these are people who are working on neighboring farms. They could be doing dairy work. They could be doing fruit picking. They could be doing
Anything laborious out in the fields and camps like that is everything they're doing. They could be working in packing plants or out in the fields or everything like that.
Right. And are the people, I imagine a lot of these people may have indeterminate status as far as the legal
authorities
are concerned.
Well, we found that most of the people are on like the H-2A farmers agreement there, but there are some, you know, that, you know, we're not really sure, but we're not really involved with that.
Right. So, so you initiate this contact and set up, you know, a health clinic or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
How long does it take? Are they comfortable sort of transmitting personal information through you to a health, you know, to a nurse practitioner or?
Well, we've been doing this for a long time, so a lot of the people recognize us when we come around. But there's some camps we go to that are, you know, this is the first time we'll go over there, and they are kind of taken back, kind of reserved for a good reason. You know what I mean?
Yep.
But most of the time, they're really appreciative that we can go out to them because they don't have the access to go into the health center, or else they would.
Right. Well, we saw this with a lot of people's access to driver's licenses. You know, for example, in Vermont, they put in some legislation so that migrant farm workers could actually have some sort of identification that meant they could actually drive a vehicle. But a lot of people are very limited, you know, when they're sort of working. So at what point do you... you mentioned building up some knowledge around medical expertise. I mean, even for people whose first language is English, as Eric said too, you know, communicating with your doctor can be a complicated thing.
Or can it ever?
Yeah. So when that's sort of amplified through the interpretation process and so on, I mean, do you find you have to check terminology, or do you have to sort of, is there some sort of interrogation process where you have to really try and identify what the person's presenting with?
One of the things that I've recognized is, to be fair, a lot of these people are not as educated to a standard of American standards, but they've dropped out of school preteen and started working as soon as they could. So a lot of people are illiterate. You know, they don't have huge vocabularies, but they don't need one because they're working. So medical terminology, I mean, if I'm translating for a Hispanic patient, I don't have to say the correct, you know, adage that a doctor would say, but I could explain it to them exactly how the doctor or nurse would want it so that they could understand, because chances are they're not really going to understand specific medical terminology.
Right.
Well, and maybe I can kick it over to Eric, the same kind of question, and we'll go off the question we had from Pat online. People who come to you, and again, if you're just joining us, Eric Candle is the president of EC Data National Training Institute, and Ty Smartpat is a field outreach interpreter with Oak Orchard Health based in Brockport. We're talking about medical interpreting, and Eric, when someone comes to your company, is there a typical route to becoming a medical interpreter?
And it's a great question, yes. And by the way, can we challenge our guests on the radio? Is it allowed or not? So, because I would.
And you might challenge...
Challenge one of our guests.
Of course.
So, yeah, absolutely. So,
yeah. Ty, get ready.
Yes. Anyway, yes, there is a path, and it's very important because we worked for over 20 years on the national certification for medical interpreters. And here is a natural progression or evolution for medical interpreters. You have to be a bilingual person, yes, because 75 to 80% of all our interpreters in the United States are non-native English speakers. They're heritage speakers, they're required speakers, Spanish speakers, English speakers. But it's simply not enough. They're not medical interpreters, they're not legal interpreters, they're not social services interpreters. And that's why the key component is obviously training. And if you would come to us, then we provide immediately training that today is a standard. There is a standard established today in the United States for medical interpreters, which is a minimum of 40 hours training. We currently provide training with MCC, Monroe Community College, State University of New York. It's a fantastic program because it's very pragmatic. It's applicational. It's not only theory, it's a shadowing practicum and giving people the opportunity to immediately apply all the knowledge that they acquire during the training. So after then, when you're done, and prerequisite, we don't allow minors to interpret. That's why you have to be 18 years old. You have to have at least high school diploma, and we're moving to the prerequisite of bachelor's degree, as our colleagues with American Sign Language, for instance, or in legal interpreting.
Right.
So you have to go through the 4-year training program, and then the next step, we now have national certification in 6 languages, which is Spanish, Cantonese, Mandarin, Korean, Vietnamese, and Russian. And after that, you are at the top of your profession. You're a certified, nationally certified medical interpreter. one of the major canons, as we call it, major principles of the Code of Ethics, and it's very important, and here what I would like in a very friendly way challenge, so accuracy and completeness. We don't explain anything to our patients. It's not our mission. It's the mission of the provider. We can do what we call an authorized practice of medicine, as we don't conduct an authorized practice of legal profession. I can, even if I know, even if I've been to the appointment for 500 times, absolutely not. It's up to the medical provider to deliver this message. If I don't know the meaning of the word, if I don't know it, and challenge, major challenge here, then in languages of lesser diffusion, imagine Burmese, Swahili, Nepali, Bhutanese, yes, Amharic. In many cases, we don't even have a baseline medical dictionaries. There is no way to deliver colonoscopy in Swahili. In this case, you will go, you know what colonoscopy is, but you don't explain it to the patient. You go to the doctor and ask the doctor to explain it. And the way the doctor explains will be delivered to the patient.
Right. And maybe, Ty, did you want to jump in on the response?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. Maybe I should clarify what I'm saying is that...
I'm not sure you're that far apart, but go ahead.
Yeah. I definitely... We translate exactly what the doctor or nurse wants, and it never wavers off. We never put our own input in. It's always what the nurse and doctor wants. So when the nurse and doctors go out there, they also recognize this, and we just simply translate what they want, but they usually are in simple terms.
Yeah.
And this way was a friendly challenge.
But I think also, I think the field work, I mean, I think there's maybe, can be different experiences in terms of building trust for people who are not presenting at a clinic saying, I need treatment. These are people that they're just trying to establish some connections with to say, we're going to come and take your blood pressure. So I think, you know, that. But just on the point, and this is something that came up in the discussions from the Refugee Health Conference last week as well, Eric, was empowering community members, that there's some interesting data coming together that's showing the efficacy of healthcare delivery if the communities themselves are empowered. Can you talk us through that in terms of what your view of developing interpretive expertise from, say, within the Bhutanese community, who we talked about as well, say, within Rochester, what are the benefits of that approach?
It's a fantastic point, because it's a collective effort. It's a collective effort of all the stakeholders within the community, including community itself. We work with all the community centers I just mentioned, you know, Sudanese, Somali community, the Bhutanese community. Among our interpreters, among our students are couple dozens of Bhutanese and Nepali interpreters. Unless you work very closely with them, you will not be able to deliver your message. And here is a key issue. We work within the catchment areas. Our major hospital facilities, they absolutely have to know who do they serve. And if I see on average that ambulatory utilization rate for native English speakers, for instance, in the United States is about 4 times a year, it's how often you see medical providers. If you go to some of the languages of minor diffusion population groups, they see doctors once in 5 years. And that's why the readmission rate is so high. If you work with them, and the reason they do, because they very often think our cultural and linguistical needs are not addressed. If we work with them, if we explain, you know, that we are in the environment when all your needs will be addressed, we will work with you, it creates a completely different level of trust and confidence. And that's why we start seeing more often. By the way, I want to commend Rochester General Hospital for a fantastic conference. It was a very important point, and a lot of issues were very, very interestingly addressed.
Right. And you've also raised the issues, and Ty, you raised this as well, just literacy and education levels generally for people who may, you know, be having contact with the system, but also things like general mobility and isolation that people within refugee communities can be experiencing
and
access, you know, where the healthcare providers are based. Yeah,
we have abnormally high level, unfortunately, in Bhutanese and Nepali community of suicide, and it was addressed in many speeches and many commentaries at the conference. And one of the reasons, you said again, that it's displacement, it's isolation, it's inability to maintain ties. People come here after 20 years of concentration camps. Obviously, incorporating them in our society here is very important, and healthcare is one of the key issues. I can give you the most recent study that show that when we asked them within the study, what was the key point that they felt that they were failing as a community within the new environment of the United States life. They said healthcare system. It's the hardest point for refugees and asylees and immigrants in the United States to incorporate into their daily life. So by addressing it through the needs of cultural interaction, professional medical interpreters, working with organizations that deal with the community, hopefully we can alleviate a lot of problems.
You hear the same thing, Ty?
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, put that on. I recently talked to a Bhutanese refugee, and he did mention the same thing about the high suicide rates and everything like this. I think the biggest thing to understand here is the difference in standard of health care in this country and other countries. It's very different. I know in Jamaica it's not as great as here, so they aren't as required to do as much or have immunizations or injections like that, you know, before they come here.
So that kind of a gap has to be understood, I guess, right? I mean, they may arrive here not knowing.
Right, and I think that's the biggest education point that we try to make when we go out to the field, is how it works here and what they should expect and what they need to learn about it.
So that's interesting in that in some ways some of the expectation is that a non-English speaking community would want certain services but would feel somewhat isolated, as Matthew, the word you used. What you're saying is that there are times where they don't know that they are supposed to or required to or have to, and that's another challenge entirely. Eric, you see the same thing?
Yes, absolutely. And I can tell you that in many cases, again, it's not only the interpreters, it's not only the community. Everybody in a vertical level who is involved in providing care, including medical providers, including administrators, they have to have the same level of understanding. Let me give you a very brief example. So here's an Arabic-speaking woman being admitted into emergency department with extensive vaginal bleeding. And the doctor immediately suggesting, again, a native English speaker, yes, doctor within the United States, very specific case of just 2 months old, immediately suggesting, so we have to do a pap smear test because we have to determine what's the cause of your vaginal bleeding. The woman rejects this completely, violently.
Out of cultural concerns.
Out of cultural concerns, not just cultural concerns, because in terms of traditional beliefs with her community, again, and I'm specifically not addressing this at the level of a concrete country, but let's say it's just a community.
Sure, sure.
So in this case, so you can lose your virginity to the medical procedure. The belief is that you can lose it simply by having a procedure. It's very important here to make sure that the cultural needs are addressed. So, and it was addressed at that encounter because of professional medical interpreter who was able to suggest to the doctor to find another way. And ultimately, another way was an ultrasonic procedure that was not invasive and didn't violate cultural beliefs of this woman.
Right. But that was an interpreter not embellishing the advice or doing diagnosis for the patient, but providing some cultural awareness to the doctor.
Beautiful. It's called cultural mediation. Within the cultural mediation, we don't give any generalization of a specific culture. Simply because you're from the United States, you know, it doesn't give me any understanding, deep understanding of your culture. The same way here, you simply suggest, well, doctor, maybe you would like to explore some issues here. And in direct communication with the patient, find the best way.
Yeah.
So we're not substituting or replacing doctor's judgment. We're raising a red flag and suggest for the doctor to explore it directly with the patient, which we call cultural humility. So we don't suggest that we know culture deep enough to understand that this specific patient has traits or features that we can immediately address.
Yeah.
So the doctor will do it.
And I imagine, Ty, I mean, also because you're dealing with people, that there is be significant differences, I guess, in your experience, if you're working across different language groups, the different issues, I mean, different kind of cultural issues might come up.
I mean, just the other night, we went to a camp of Mexicans from Michoacan, and the part of Michoacan they're from are natives, and they speak their own language, Tarasco. And we found that in a group of 18 guys, only 3 guys spoke Spanish. The rest spoke their native tongue, and that's all they spoke. And that was really eye-opening for me because, you know, I'm the one out there who's actually supposed to be translating, but it ended up me translating to another guy who was translating to his friend because Tarasco, no one really speaks it except these people. And, you know, that's a huge barrier if we look at it like that, you know what I'm saying? So
that's a fascinating example where all the best laid plans, and there you have to kind of improvise to some extent
to do it. Eye-opening to see that these people, you know, these are problems that exist.
So just a money question, Eric, in terms of, so obviously we're looking at the benefits of limiting readmission, providing more effective care, that kind of thing. How are hospital administrators and, I guess, healthcare, you know, the healthcare industry thinking or not thinking about medical interpretation in your experience?
You're reading my mind, you know. So it's incredible. 10-12 years ago.
Get closer to the mic again there, Eric. There you go.
Yes, I'm going to get more space.
Our listeners can't see that. When he gets fired up, he leans back a little there. So go ahead,
10-12 years ago, it was a common practice, unfortunately, to use family members or minors or not use professional medical interpreters at all. It's changing, and we're blessed in this community. In our major medical facilities, we do have professional medical interpreting departments. But there is some room for improvement, always. And here is how we can do it in this case. It's unfunded mandate today. So providing medical interpreting services, in many cases, it's a major challenge for administrators and top management of medical facilities. New York State, to some extent, is an exceptional state because we're only among 14 states in the nation when Medicaid, and 55% of all LEP patients are in Medicaid. Medicaid provides reimbursement for medical interpreting services at up to $22 or up to 20 minutes. So after that, up to 2 hours, it's still $22. So it's a beginning. We're now working on a major nationwide project, and the goal of the project is to show the efficacy of professional medical interpreters, not simply bilingual individuals, but professional medical interpreters. And then it will go to the centers of Medicaid and Medicare, who suggested specifically, if you can show that professional medical services, medical interpreting services, can drastically decrease the cost of services, increase patient safety, reduce 30 days readmission rate, take care of the issues of liability. We have liabilities of about $250 million lawsuits in the United States that you never read about because they will settle out of court. If you can take care of these issues to some extent, then Centers for Medicaid and Medicare will provide compensation for medical interpreting services.
Yeah, they'll happily cover it if they think that it's a money saver.
Yes, absolutely. And the key issue here is that if you work with a provider, and provider on average has 12, 13 minutes to be in the United States in a medical encounter. If you are unprofessional medical interpreter, you will take the duration of the encounter to the level of 1 hour, 1 hour and 10 minutes. I can make my business plan for a day as a medical provider. Whereas if you are a professional medical interpreter, the increase is only 0.6%. So instead of 12 minutes, you will see 13, 14 minutes. So that's why money is right there. You're saving money by providing qualified professional medical interpreters.
And we're almost out of time, but Ty, it sounds like something that Oak Orchard Health has kind of worked out. You talked about the demand, that the kind of demand is there. It's immediate. It's like right now. But obviously, in terms of its health provision, your organization obviously sees enormous value in having people like yourself and the team that you work with able to work alongside providers.
I mean, it's not just me going out into the fields. I mean, we also have interpreters inside the health center, and they're as qualified as this gentleman over here is explaining how they should be. And that's what we seek to do, is offer. We're almost a shadow. We're not really there. We're trying to explain everything as if we are the doctor, the word of the doctor. You know what I'm saying? So it's in that way.
No, absolutely.
Fascinating stuff and great discussion from our guests, Eric Candle, the president of EC Data National Training Institute and the U.S. coordinator for the International Medical Interpreters Association. Eric, thank you for being here once again.
Thank you very much.
And Ty Smarpat, field outreach interpreter for Oak Orchard Health. Thank you, Ty.
Thank you very much.
Short break. Coming right back, more with Matthew Leonard and the team from Innovation Trail. In fact, we'll check in around the state when we come back on member-supported public radio. Monday on The Next Connections, Assembly Minority Leader Brian Kolb joins us for the first hour. He'll explain what Republicans think about the recent legislative session, from medical marijuana to spending and other issues. And speaking of medical marijuana, it passed with some exceptions and provisions. Everything you need to know about medical marijuana in New York State, the how, the when, the where, coming Monday on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Cure, a restaurant in Rochester's public market serving interpretations of French farmhouse cuisine and featuring a selection of wine and cocktails. Open for dinner Wednesday through Sunday, serving brunch on Sundays. Outdoor seating available, curebar.net.
Welcome back to Innovation Friday and Connections. I'm Evan Dawson with the monthly co-host of this event. It's Matthew Leonard, the editor of the Innovation Trail. And now is a good time to check in with the team around the state, Matthew.
Absolutely. Jenna Flanagan from WMHT in Albany is on the line with us. Jenna, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good.
This is thanks very much for joining us. You filed a story. We wanted to check in with you on a story that you've been working on for New York Now, public PBS production out of your station there in Albany. On you produced something on the Campus Safety Act. Tell us a little bit about why you tackled that. What's interesting about the Campus Safety Act?
Well, first of all, it's very much in the zeitgeist at the moment. The U.S. Department of Education is investigating several schools, but four New York State schools, including the University of Binghamton, Hobart and William.
Hobart and William Smith, yep, in Geneva.
Yeah, William Smith, okay, so anyway, a couple of
Hunter College
around the area.
Hunter College and can't remember the other one.
Exactly. Oh, God, it's escaping my mind right now. But the point is that they're all under investigation for how they're handling sexual assault complaints on their campus. And this sort of flies in the face because this law was put on the books, a Campus Safety Act, in 1999. It was after, I'm not sure if people from the Rochester area are familiar with, but it was a big case here in Albany where a young woman at the University of Albany, Suzanne Lyle, disappeared. So that was in 1998. This law was put on the books in 1999. And basically what it did was it created a written agreement between universities and police departments as to what they were going to do should a sexual assault happen or a student be declared missing. Now, what happened, unfortunately, is that a written agreement is only as good as the paper that it's written on. So a lot of universities and colleges weren't necessarily adhering to it. So then the legislature went back and they decided, okay, well, we're going to re-up this bill, and now we're going to add a 24-hour notice to it. Well, again, that's only as good as the agreement that's being made. In the sense that, yes, if you have a case with a missing person, then, of course, time is of the essence. And notifying the police is incredibly important within 24 hours. However, because the bill has to stay in line with the Victims' Rights Bill, or the Victims' Rights Act, excuse me, you can only notify authorities, the police department, if the victim gives their consent.
Right.
So whether or not a sexual assault gets reported determines really heavily on where the victim is in their decision-making process. And then there's also the added issue of who exactly has jurisdiction over the case, because if the case is put in the hands of a police department, say if it happened off campus or something, then it might be the municipal police department. But if it happens on campus, then a lot of schools and universities will say, well, we still have jurisdiction over this, so we're going to handle how it is investigated. And that can also determine whether or not the assault even gets reported in the Clery Act, because a lot of schools will say, well, there was no conviction, so there's nothing for us to even report to the Clery Act in terms of the number of sexual assault crimes that happen on our campus.
Right. And the Clery Act requires institutions to actually have the policy that encourages reporting, but then you're saying that it's also the offset is the Federal Campus Sexual Assault Victims Bill of Rights, which actually gives the victim the right on whether they want to report the offence or not. So you've got a mixture of a classic kind of mix of jurisdictions that obviously makes this a pretty dense and difficult kind of set of processes.
Yeah. And then there's also the added issue that some people say, well, you know, it's actually much better if you really want to help the victim, then what you really need to do is not send them to a police department and immediately report this crime to a police, but send them to a victim's rights advocate. And that person can then help the victim process not only the trauma that they've gone through, but then lay out all of their choices before them and clearly explain how the system works, et cetera, and then the decision can be made. Now, of course, that does, again, bring up the question of timing. You know, there are statute of limitations questions to be considered. But for the most part, from at least from the victims' advocates groups that I've spoken with, they've all said that most victims, once paired up with an advocate, feel a lot more empowered, shall we say, to then go to the police, because they feel as though they're not getting railroaded by another group. They feel as though they now have the power of how they're going to handle this situation, et cetera.
Right. So that report from Jenna Flanagan, Innovation Trail's Jenna Flanagan in New York Now, which is on PBS and it's online. You'll be able to check it out online. And Jenna, just before we let you go, I just wanted to let people know about a little project that you started this month for this was actually National Homeowners Month, Evan. And National Homeowners Month is really just sort of an awareness-raising thing about the resources that are out there for people to access help with getting their own home. We know that credit's incredibly tight. Jenna, you've sort of embarked on you've taken the first baby steps to achieve the goal of home ownership in your part of the world, and you're blogging it on a WordPress blog that's kind of going to capture the steps along the journey.
Yeah, I have been literally capturing all of the steps from the very beginning. And my Tumblr site, just shameless plug here, is nysjenna.tumblr.com. And basically what it is, I had casually gone to a press event with the Attorney General, and he happened to mention something called the First Time Home Buyers Club, which, of course, rang off all kinds of bells in my head because I want to be a first-time home buyer. And once, you know, looking into this, I found out that not only are there organizations out there throughout the state of New York that are specifically in place to help get people of all income levels, not just high-income earners, but even low-income level people, into homes of their own, but there's also all sorts of grants and loans and federal loans that are given at a much, much lower rate than you would a bank loan, and encouraging people to buy homes. So I have been following all of this, and if you're at all interested in my process of a modest income person hoping to buy a home, please follow my Tumblr.
nysjenna.tumblr.com. Jenna's got a really great humorous outlook and a good turn of phrase, so I'd highly recommend that, as well as being a great reporter for the Innovation Trail, doing hard news stories like the Campus Safety Act. Jenna Flanagan, thanks very much for being with us on Innovation Friday.
All right, thank you.
And just we've got time to squeeze in one more story just to move a little bit further south. I wanted to let listeners have a chance to hear a really great report from Matt Richmond, Innovation Trail. He's now news director at WSKG based out of Binghamton. He and the Allegheny Front, which is an environmental reporting project based in Pittsburgh at WESA, they looked at the debate over drilling waste in New York State. Listeners will be aware that the fracking moratorium is still in place, that the health review is still in place. It's been an incredibly contentious 5 or 6 years talking about fracking in the state. But nevertheless, the impacts of fracking in Pennsylvania are being felt right now amongst communities in New York State. In this particular story we're about to hear, Matt Richmond reports on landfills that are taking in plenty of solid waste from Pennsylvania's gas boom. And that solid waste has a lot of people in the area worried. Here's his report.
All rocks have some radiation in them, but the Marcellus Shale is an unusually radioactive underground formation. A recent study found it's 3 times higher than in other rock layers. The element of greatest concern is radium. And that's what Larry Schilling has to watch out for.
The stuff with the plastic there, that is drill cuttings.
Schilling is vice president of Casella Waste Systems. The company operates the Chemung County Landfill, where piles of drill cuttings trucked in from Marcellus Shale wells in nearby Pennsylvania are scattered around the yard. The cuttings look like heaps of wet black sand wrapped in a black plastic liner. They are actually a mixture of rock cut through the gas-rich Marcellus Shale, fluids called drilling mud used to help bore the well, and liquids found deep underground. All this material comes up before a well is fracked. It doesn't include fracking chemicals. Schilling sits in a pickup truck at the landfill, watching trucks loaded with piles of dirt crawl by. They're not allowed to take cuttings that are too radioactive.
See this thing that says Ludlam?
Schilling points out a pair of white tubes, each about 5 feet tall, sitting on posts at the entrance to the landfill.
So they pull up, they stop, and then as they drive onto the scales, it registers what radioactivity might be in it.
The machine is a Ludlam Model 375P1000. In the business, it's called a scintillating detector. It measures gamma radiation coming off of a dump truck. The readings feed into a small monitor inside the landfill's office. Schilling says they've never had a load of cuttings that exceeded acceptable levels of radiation enter the site. states in and around the fracking boom are working through what to do about all this naturally radioactive waste from drilling. Pennsylvania is conducting a study of radiation in the Marcellus Shale. West Virginia passed a law segregating drill cuttings from other parts of landfills. Casella wants New York state regulators to let the company take even more drill cuttings from Pennsylvania. But not everyone is convinced this landfill is taking sufficient precautions. Gary Abraham is an environmental lawyer in western New York, working to block Casella from expanding its landfills. Abraham says there's so much radiation in the deep shale rocks that it must inevitably be getting into landfills. He points to radioactivity readings taken by New York state regulators of the salty water found in the Marcellus Shale. This water, which comes up during and after fracking, is called brine.
The radioactivity of the brine is as high as 15,000 picocuries per liter. The background radiation at the surface of the earth in New York is about 1 picocurie per liter.
Schilling says while brine can be more radioactive, the cuttings are benign. In fact, says Schilling, testing they commissioned on the Marcellus showed very little radiation in the cuttings.
The highest reading we got from any of those four samples was 4.3 picocuries per gram, still under the cleanup standard that EPA set for cleaning up sites.
The difference? One is looking at the brine associated with the Marcellus Shale and raising the red flag. The other is just focused on the rock and giving the green light. The natural radiation in the Marcellus, particularly in the brine that comes out of it during and after fracking, is well established. Avner Vengosh is a geochemist at Duke University. He found radium in a Pennsylvania stream near a plant that processed fracking wastewater at 200 times background level. Vengosh says there's a risk that once the radium locked deep underground gets into streams and rivers, it will make its way into fish and eventually into people.
Radium is very similar to calcium, and as a result, it would accumulate in the bone and start radiation, which would lead to bone cancer.
The particular form of radium found in the shale, radium-226, has a half-life of more than 5,000 years. So basically, once it gets into the environment, it's there for good. Since contaminants started showing up in streams, Pennsylvania has tightened restrictions on the disposal of wastewater. But the treatment of solid waste at places like the Chemung County landfill in New York concerns Vengosh.
Every contaminant that is being disposed into landfill, the solids are subject to numerous attack of acid and different chemicals, different solution within the landfill, and they creating what we call leachates.
Leachate. It's basically garbage tea. Anything that's in the landfill, like radium, can get into it. What happens to the leachate? It comes here.
We are at the Chemung County Sewer District on Lake Street in Elmira. And this is a 12 million gallon per day trickling filter plant.
The plant handles about 6 million gallons of wastewater a day. The landfill sends up to 30,000 gallons a day for treatment. Dan McGovern is the plant's chief operator. McGovern says they're only certified to do basic tests at their on-site lab. They can check for solids, pH levels, dissolved oxygen, and salts. But do they test for radium? McGovern says no.
That would have to be something that they would have to?
They would have to actually send it out to a very sophisticated lab to test that, yes.
The treatment plant tests the water when it comes in and when it goes out, into the Chemung River, but never for radiation. Casella does a quarterly radiation test of its leachate. Results showed low levels of radium-226, but with each testing, there was a small increase. In New York, Marcellus Shale drill cuttings are exempted from the regulations governing low-level radioactive waste. If they weren't, landfills couldn't take them, and leachate would have to go to specialized treatment plants that can handle hazardous waste.
And that report was from WSKG's Matt Richmond. That was part of a joint project that he's doing with the environmental reporting project, the Allegheny Front, based out of Pittsburgh, public radio in Pittsburgh. And timely, as you were mentioning off mic, Evan, because we're expecting the New York State Court of Appeal to deliver their decision on the subject of home rule. people might remember this is the case with the towns of Dryden and Middleburg, who were being taken to court by Norse Energy, which is now a bankrupt company, but the trustees for that company are still continuing the court case. It's essentially challenging what right towns have to control what resource development goes on within the town boundaries.
And those are the towns, the municipalities involved in the lawsuit, but we've seen other municipalities try to make decisions on fracking.
Avon
is an example.
Yes, right.
And this will be very, very interesting because you talk to people there in these individual municipalities and they say, well, we're not making a decision for statewide fracking. We're talking about having our own decision-making process. And
right.
Generally, people who are pro-fracking in New York State oppose home rule because they don't want these carve-outs, but people in these municipalities disagree. So that'll be very interesting to see.
So that if you're a Court of Appeals watcher, you should check out
the
website.
Or you might become a Court of Appeals watcher next week.
9 a.m. is when they update the website. I think either Monday or Tuesday is likely to be the decision will be posted. The appeal was heard a couple of months ago.
And wouldn't that be interesting if they decide to uphold home rule? There's a lot of assumption that the governor, after the election, will allow for some fracking, maybe an exploratory 20 wells, 5 counties, that kind of a thing. But very interesting to see if home rule, once that starts to happen, how home rule ends up impacting.
It's a crucial question, and the kind of the legal precedent for it will have big implications, I think, on a lot of things. But as we heard in Matt's story, the fact is that a lot of communities, particularly along the southern tier, have been dealing with the implications of fracking across the border for years now. So it's already having its effect.
Every day, every week, you hear the reporting of the Innovation Trail, and certainly online at WXXINews.org. But we always appreciate having a special showcase show for them the fourth Friday of every month. It's Innovation Friday. Matthew Leonard, the editor of the Innovation Trail. Easy for me to say now.
Right.
It's a good thing it's Friday. We're all ready for the weekend.
That's right.
Thank you, sir.
Terrific. Thanks, Evan. Thanks for the chance to have some longer conversations.
There you go. And John Andrews behind the glass. Always nice working with you, John. Nice chatting with you, our listeners. And have a wonderful weekend. We'll see you on Member Supported Public Radio on a Monday.